This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brenton Octagal.
Hello.
When America withdrew from Afghanistan this past summer, President Joe Biden said America would be out of Iraq this year. Well, he's keeping that promise, and Iran is making sure of it. Nations throughout the Middle East are bracing themselves for America's complete withdrawal. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is a phased approach for the United States leaving Iraq. It's in everybody's memories, most notably the nations of the Middle East, the allies of the United States, what's just happened in Afghanistan. And really, they are terrified that they're going to see something like that happen in Iraq as well. Just this week, the United States changed from an actual combat role of its 2,500 troops left in Iraq to an advisory role of those troops, meaning that there's no active combat missions. If they are attacked, they are able to defend themselves. But there's no more fighting against Islamic State. There's no more proactive actions against Iranian militias unless attacked first. The United States is purely now reduced to an advisory and training role of the Iraqi military. Now, this is really, I think, an intermediate step that is going to take place before the full United States withdrawal from Iraq. This is something that Bible prophecy and the Trumpet and Mr. Gerald Flurry have talked about that it is going to happen for the last couple of decades. And we're always building towards this moment that the last U.S. soldier leaves Iraq. And it must be understood that not everyone in Iraq actually wants the United States to leave. You've only got the pro-Iranian elements inside the Iraqi government, which make up about half to just over half of the government, of the parliamentarians that are very much pro-Iran, answer to Iran, and not just pro-Iran, because there's always pro other nation elements inside foreign nations. They are actual pro-Iranian revolution, meaning that we want to support Iran's revolution. We're a part of their alliance. That's inside the Iraqi government. And so you have those forces that have been most vocal and part of the fighting forces against U.S. forces that are actually pushing or desires for the U.S. to leave. And then you have more of the Iraqi nationalists that desire the United States presence to stay there because they see it as the only chance, the only hope of their nation not being a complete vassal to the Iranians. So this week, it's another big step in that direction, taking away the active combat role of U.S. forces to basically saying they're sitting back and they're going to train and advise the Iraqi military, some of which are those very pro-Iranian, same pro-Iranian forces.
So it's an interesting posture that the United States is taking. They're saying we're going to leave these forces in there, but they're no longer combat forces. They're just advisory forces. Iran seems to be saying even that's not good enough. We want you out completely. If I'm understanding this right, the United States is saying, no, we're not going to bow to that kind of pressure. But there's this definite sense that they don't want to alienate or anger Iran too much because Iran is actually making these retaliatory or these strikes against U.S. forces that the United States wants to try to avoid as much as it possibly can. There's a lot of factors at play here that seem to underscore the weakness of America's position and the strength of Iran's position.
Right. This action is straight up appeasement of Iran. And it is... If America was acting as a position of strength, you would say that, oh, we're just keeping our soldiers there. And you strike us, we'll strike you back tenfold. But that hasn't happened. U.S. forces are under attack in Iraq, weekly. Weekly the bases are being attacked. Weekly the green zone by the... No, you're not hearing about these things. These are missile attacks that are taking place by Iranian-backed Iraqi militias, that some of them are actually part of the Iraqi military. They're the ones fighting against Americans, wanting them to leave the country. And they have said, no, we want a full withdrawal, not this changing of the code, changing of the status, but by the end of December, we want you fully gone. And it's like this moment that the United States is saying that, okay, we hear what you're saying. We're not going to be actively fighting anymore. We're just going to sit tight for a little bit. Now, you might say this is actually surprisingly strong from the United States to not just up and leave. However, what does it say? It says to the Iranians that, well, the America will leave. It's just a matter of time. And perhaps if this will actually encourage more American attacks against American forces in Iraq. Again, there are not every Iraqi wants to just be beholden to Iran. I would say most of the populace doesn't want to be. And they're hoping, they're out on the streets protesting, watching, like fearing for their lives to try and keep Iraq away from Iran entirely. And the United States presence there is their only hope. But it's hard to see that is going to happen at all. And biblical prophecy indicates that the U.S. will up and go shortly.
Now, I do want to get to how other countries in the region are responding, but if I can just draw attention to one point. This was in the the Times of Israel had this article and quoted one analyst, Nicholas Harris of the New Lines Institute in Washington. He said the White House is well aware that if the United States rocks the boat too much in Iraq, Iran-backed militias will attack U.S. forces, which could ruin American public opinion on staying in the nuclear talks with Iran. So he's talking about the fact that we've got to keep things kind of on the level because they're working so hard to try to preserve this moribund, completely farcical nuclear deal. It shows that, I mean, the tortured logic is quite something to behold here.
Yeah. It certainly is. It's the same logic that took place back when the first nuclear deal was being negotiated, how everything in the region that America did was connected to their desire for a nuclear deal. If Iranian ally Bashar al-Assad in Syria uses chemical weapons on his people, Barack Obama said it's a red line, we're going in, we're going to oust him from, he's going to be removed from power. Assad does that. And then the United States is basically, Barack Obama walks back that promise basically because he knows that Iran is going to walk away from a nuclear deal if he attacks Assad. And so everything is in the pursuit of a nuclear deal. And Iran can do what it likes. And basically the U.S. fears any type of action, strong action against Iran or an Iranian ally or perceived action against Iran or an Iranian ally gives Iran a free ticket to walk away from the talks. And so they're using that as their rationale to really bow to Iran on these lesser issues as they would keep it, or as they would see it, in preservation to preserve the greater deal, the greater goal of a nuclear deal. And yet, as we covered last week, they want so much to give them the bomb. They want so much to fund the Iranians. They want so much to allow them and give them cover to continue producing a nuclear weapon. And they're basically trying to find any way to provide diplomatic cover for their own people to pay Iran money. This is what it's about. Can the United States actively fund and support the Islamic Republic of Iran while it's beholden to the American population, the American populace, the American voters, because that's entirely a very horrible position for them politically. And so they need to produce excuses. Yes, we're weak in Iraq. Yes, we're going to leave in Iraq, but at least we're going after the Iran nuclear deal to supposedly stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon so it doesn't use it against Israel. That's all for domestic consumption. The real thing that's happening is America is leaving. America is supporting Iran's move towards a nuclear weapon and supporting moves towards funding the Iranian regime in any way possible.
So the weakness of America is breathtaking to witness. Everyone can see it. You have nations all over the Middle East who, when Donald Trump was in power, you had this interesting coalition starting to develop among several Arab nations and even together with Israel. Now all of these nations are basically saying, what do we do in America's absence? The evacuation from Afghanistan was a spectacular punch in the face to America's reputation internationally. Leaving Iraq really has very strong geostrategic implications for some of these Arab states. How are they responding to the news of what's happening here?
Right. So you do have some, you know, negotiations between Saudis, Emiratis, and the Iraqi government to try and see if it's even possible to pull them away from Iran. I think they know that it's not possible. You do have Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader, that is actually warming in his ties towards the UAE, the Gulf states. They've been visiting with him, which is interesting. We know biblical prophecy.
These are people that said that they wanted him out just a few years ago, and it looked like the winds were blowing against him. And so it really does show you just how much things have changed for Syria and for him specifically in the time since.
Right. I think his it's actually looking pretty good for him going forward. I think both the Iranians, the Russians, and also the Gulf states know that they would like Assad on their side. And so realpolitik is taking over here. Even though they don't like him, he might be a good one for the future to have in their bag. It is tremendously interesting to look at this in terms of biblical prophecy. And I'll speak about why, because we have said for the longest time that all of the important biblical prophecies for the end time in the Middle East occur in a power vacuum, which is created by America's exit. And so we knew that America was going to leave the stage. And yet you have first the Obama administration. We could say that policy, as well as this Biden administration's policy, they're identical. We are leaving, and on the way out, we are empowering your enemy. Our former allies are no longer our allies. We are now empowering Iran. The effect of that is all the allies of the anti-Iranian coalition comes together in a very close way, something that we haven't seen before. Gulf states, Turkey's going to be pushed into this alliance. Even now, it looks like Syria is going to come into this alliance as well. And then Trump comes in, and what does he do? He says, America's leaving from the region, and so you guys need to organize a collective defense. Involve Israel. Israel's the strong horse. Gulf states, quit with this feuding against Israel. You know your real enemy is in Iran. Get together. You don't need us here. You're strong enough to counter the Iranian threat. And so he says that, you know, America still has your back, but this is more of an active coalition building amongst the nations in the Middle East. The net effect is you have a warming ties between the anti-Iranian alliance. Biden gets in and he basically says the same thing as Obama. And what's the net effect? Again, a strengthening of this anti-Iranian alliance. And so biblical prophecy said that this was going to happen, that the United States was going to leave, that Iran would rise, but there would also be the formation of another alliance, which is mentioned in Psalm 83. This is the moderate Arab states coming together, perhaps even for a time with Israel. We know eventually that will actually bust up and this alliance will become against Israel. However, again, the United States is absent. And so what motivates these close ties between the Saudis, Jordan, and the Emiratis? Eventually it'll be Turkey, and eventually it'll be Lebanon, Syria. We already see it taking place with Syria. We see it is, yes, a rising Iran, but it's also this absence of the United States. And so biblical prophecy said this was going to happen. It doesn't matter if Obama's in power or Trump's in power. The way it happens would be different, but the net result is the same. Two alliances forming in the Middle East. One, a moderate Arab alliance, which we call the Psalm 83 alliance. The other, the King of the South, a radical Islamic alliance led by Iran. And Israel, little Israel for the time being, with its back against the wall, with the United States going out, is starting to trust more in the Arab states, which again foretells or forebodes another biblical prophecy as well.
Fascinating stuff. Brent, where would you send people for more information on these prophecies?
I think an article from 2019 entitled America is Backing Out. The last half of this goes through those prophecies.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent. Just a couple of years ago, it seemed strongmen were taking over Europe. This week, Austria's strongman is abruptly gone, and not a strongman, but Angela Merkel left office. We're seeing a real power vacuum in Europe. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it really is all change in Europe this week. Like you mentioned, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, bowed out on Wednesday to be replaced by Olaf Scholz. And right around the same time, or just a few days earlier on December 2nd in Austria, you had a big change in their leadership. So the former Austrian chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, he kind of officially bowed out of politics. And then his replacement as chancellor, Alexander Schallenberg, he also bowed out of politics right on the same day. And you know, even though Kurz had given up the job title, he was quite obviously the power behind the throne. To have both of them step down right around the same time was just this big change for Austria that kind of hit people right out of the blue. I don't think anyone was expecting those two to go. Something that's probably a much more of a genuine leadership change than we saw when Kurz stepped down initially. And what this does, I think, is whenever you look around Europe, you do see quite a lot of weak leadership. You see people that have, strong leaders that have kind of tried to come in, like Kurz, and maybe had some success for a while, but they're in some kind of trouble. So in October, in the Czech Republic, you had the Czech prime minister, kind of the strong man there, Andrej Babiš. He lost an election. In Italy, Matteo Salvini was kind of a potential strong man there who really modeled himself after Mussolini. And in recent years and months, he's kind of been outmaneuvered a bit in politics, still a force to be reckoned with. But he's been having his kind of authority cut down and not playing the role that he might have played in the past. Germany, I don't think in terms of Angela Merkel leaving, it's not like they've lost this massive strong leader, but she was a leader that was there for 16 years. So they've lost somebody that certainly has some experience, some heft, someone that definitely people would listen to, and has been replaced by Olaf Scholz, whose government has put forwards quite a lot of left-wing policies that nobody really thought they were voting for, and is much more of an unknown than Angela Merkel. So I think it is fascinating that you see this big trend all across Europe where, you know, we've talked quite a lot on this show about the need for European strongmen, about all of the problems that are confronting Europe. You know, they need a Putin to be able to stand up of their own, to stand up against Putin. They've got all these problems in the Middle East that America's not dealing with, and so that they will have to. There's the potential for migrant crisis. You know, there's the economic problems, all of these. And yet you've got, if anything, the strong leaders like Kurz bowing out. And that is really, I think, one of the big trends that stands out from the last week or two.
It's so interesting to see this happening, because when those strongmen were coming to power, we were looking at that as evidence of fulfilled prophecy. The crises that Europe is facing were demanding greater leadership to step up, and you had what appeared to be a very clear evidence of that taking place. You had a lot of electorates within European nations who said, we need the Putin in our country. We need someone who's able to meet these challenges that are rising in the world. It's a strong indication, one, of how sometimes events really do take left turns. They take the path from the prophecy in the Bible to the fulfillment is not a straight line from A to B. A lot of times it takes turns that we just can't anticipate. The other thing that this just brings to mind for me is the prophecy of the Europe that is going to emerge at the end. It talks about a Europe that is iron and clay. It's a combination. It's an unwieldy combination that only lasts for a very short time. And you see these strongmen who've come to power, they bring problems themselves with them, and they might be able to accomplish something in a short time, but then it seems like their own peccadilloes and problems catch up with them, and it creates, it prevents them from being able to maybe fully realize their ambitions. And in a sense, it's almost like a very small, it's a microcosm of what we're going to be expecting, because the Bible talks about that rule being very short-lived.
Yeah, what this brings to mind to me, especially kind of in relation to that first point, is watching Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg. You know, we had this individual that really strongly, you know, he had a whole lot of reasons that looked like he or still looks like he would fulfill that prophecy of a strong man coming to power in Germany. And we kind of really highlighted him as a very strong contender for that position. And he was Germany's defense minister, and he was making all of these changes that kind of fundamentally changed the role that Europe, the German military played within German society. And then he leaves the picture. And one of the points that we've had several articles making since then is, in a lot of ways, him leaving the picture. I mean, like you said, it's not something that we anticipated, but you can still see how it plays into Bible prophecy and how it could just make that appetite, the absence of any strong leadership, could make that appetite for strong leadership even stronger. And we've kind of said all along, well, this is just paving the way for an even bigger comeback. And in all probability, zu Guttenberg will be back and will still play that role. And I think you could see the absence of Sebastian Kurz and some of these others playing exactly the same role. I mean, I don't know. I think there is a bit of mystery behind Kurz's disappearance or resignation, the way it came out of the blue, the way that they kind of...
You think he could come back? You think that this might be a game that he's playing?
Yes. Yeah, I think maybe, but certainly you can see maybe these strong leaders kind of felt like they weren't being given the power that they needed to fix these problems. And they kind of thought, well, rather than be saddled with the blame for these problems, perhaps we should just get out, and then, you know, people will become more desperate. I think that's certainly, you know, you saw that we're seeing that kind of play out with zu Guttenberg. I think we could see that play out with others. We have an article on this on our website, Our Europe Strongman History. It's a good article by our German correspondent Joshua Michels covering a lot of this. But one of the points I like that he made at the end is he really brought out some quotes that Herbert W. Armstrong has said about the Catholic Church. And there are very specific prophecies in Revelation 17. It says that this European nation is going to come together and it's going to be led by a church. And Mr. Armstrong, based on those prophecies, said, well, it can't work without a church. And he even, you know, he pointed to all of the friction and the trouble and the kind of the iron and clay unity in Europe. And how hard these European leaders tried to get together without the church, and said, well, no, it's not going to work until you get the Catholic Church involved. And he pointed out, well, maybe this will play a certain role in how we're seeing this circumstance play out. These strong men, certainly people like Kurz, worked with the church to a certain extent, but maybe they need a much stronger relationship with the Catholic Church to succeed. And perhaps that's something that we'll see develop as these kind of leaders retreat and then come back. So it's certainly an interesting situation. Whatever is going on behind the scenes, it's clear that this is going to increase the vacuum, the leadership vacuum in Europe. It's going to increase the amount of desperation for someone that's going to put in a strong leader. And these prophecies are from the Bible that talk about authoritarian kings. Revelation 17 talks about Daniel 8, talks about the strong man. You know, that when you have no strong leadership anywhere, that is just going to increase that appetite for strong leadership, and we will see that very soon within Europe.
Well, very good. I would recommend that you go and check out Josue Michel's article, Are Europe's Strongmen History? We thank you very much for that, Richard. The relationship between Russia and India has taken a leap forward this week. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russian President Vladimir Putin traveled to New Delhi on Monday, where he met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And the two announced afterward that they're extending a major program for military and technical cooperation, and also that they had signed just a whole raft of bilateral defense agreements. So the two also came to some significant agreements with the production of coal and steel and fertilizer, and with some major energy projects and in some other economic areas. But the big news really is the military cooperation that they agreed to. One of the major military deals greenlights India to open up a massive factory in Uttar Pradesh to manufacture Russia's most famous assault rifle, the Kalashnikov, or the AK assault rifle. So that's a joint venture. And India will be building about 600,000 of the AK-203 model. So that's the gas-powered, magazine-fed, just very effective and very lethal rifle. And soon India's soldiers will be armed with more than 500,000 of these Russian rifles that are made right there in India. There was also a major agreement for military technical cooperation that will last until 2031. So that's basically extending an existing protocol that would have expired at the end of this year, but now it'll be going strong for another decade and just, you know, clearing the way for Russia and India to continue deepening all areas of military cooperation. And then they also announced that the plan for Russia to supply India with the S-400 air defense missile systems would go ahead. So there have already been some deliveries of those, but there was some question about whether the deliveries would continue. And now Russia and India have said, yes, those deliveries to India will continue. So we know that Russia and India have been close partners for many years, but it looks like after this visit by Putin to India, just his second visit outside of Russia since the whole pandemic began, and with all the military deals that resulted from this, it looks like that partnership will be deepened and expanded and just attaining new levels.
So this is something that the United States has actually tried to prevent. We've had a strong alliance with India. India seems to be basically staking its future on a stronger relationship with Russia than with the United States.
That's right. Yeah, India is supposed to be a close partner to America. It's the world's largest democracy. It's a member of the Quad Group under U.S. leadership. So India is just an invaluable partner to America, especially in the mission to stand up to China's increasing belligerence. But India really hasn't been as devoted to the U.S. as Washington would like for it to be, and that is especially true when it comes to Russia. The U.S. has actually been trying to stop really all nations from buying Russian military gear, and India is one of Russia's largest purchasers. It actually buys more of its weaponry from Russia than from any other nation. The U.S. has also tried to convince India to instead buy more U.S. weaponry and to boost interoperability with American forces instead. But as you said, India seems to be declining on all of that, and it's even risking U.S. sanctions with some of the advanced weapons it's buying from Russia, such as that S-400 missile defense system. So there have been plenty of questions lately about India's true alignment, its true, you know, geopolitical loyalty, and which way it would lean if it had to choose between the U.S. and Russia. And now we have this major meeting between Putin and Modi and just a whole raft of defense agreements that resulted from it. And I think this could shape up to be a considerable blow to U.S.-India relations and just a real step forward for India-Russia ties.
This is really exactly what we would expect based on Bible prophecy.
It is. Yeah, on Trumpet Hour, we often discuss the army of 200 million soldiers that Bible prophecy says will form in a time period called the latter years. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy that goes through really all of the various Bible passages about this Asian power. And the scriptures, especially a passage in Ezekiel 38, shows that it will be led by Russia. But then that same passage goes on to list some ancient names referring to the people that now make up India. That's in verse 5 of that chapter. So we expect all of this to come to pass soon, and with India now drawing closer to Russia and just depending quite a bit more heavily on Russia, even at risk of damaging its relations with the U.S., I think we can see that the stage is really being set for India to take its place in that Kings of the East alliance.
Where would you send people to learn about those prophecies, Jeremiah?
That that booklet I just mentioned there, there's an entire chapter devoted to India and its role in the Asian alliance. Chapter 5 is called India, Asia's Other Economic Powerhouse. So we can leave a link to that booklet in the show notes, and it does a powerful job of just putting all this in the bigger picture.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. While Russia is strengthening ties with India, this is against the backdrop of the fact that it's ramping up the threat of invading Ukraine. Now, in the past, the United States has taken significant steps to defend Ukraine from such threats, but that's changing significantly. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, things are really heating up on the Ukrainian border. Depending on the report you read, there's between 70 and 90,000 Russian troops amassing there. Jeremiah's actually been covering this for the past, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, it seems. So he gave me permission to talk about it this week, especially because Joe Biden is involved. Now, just for a little bit of a backdrop here, in Ukraine, when Ukraine left the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union broke up, America convinced them to give up their nuclear weapons. And then in order to do that, we promised them that we'd defend their territorial integrity from the Russians. And then in order to get the Russians to go along with all this, we promised them that we wouldn't try to pull Ukraine into NATO. And well, in the decades since then, a bunch of different leaders have broken a bunch of different of those promises. George Bush saying that actually trying to pull Ukraine into NATO, and then Barack Obama not defending Ukraine's territorial integrity and letting the Russians take Crimea. And so that's kind of the backdrop of what's happening right now is there's serious talk about them, the Russians taking de facto control of the Donbass region. It's two big provinces right on the very far eastern side of Ukraine. And so there was apparently a phone call between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin this week. Some news sources identified it as tense. I don't know how tense it would be because it seemed like Putin got everything he wanted, where Biden came out and the day after the call, and he affirmed that America, there was no chance we're sending any troops over to Ukraine. And has been definitely been rumors that he's even pressuring the president of Ukraine to like just surrender and give Putin what he wants. Mm. With other government officials coming out and even trying to like talk about an evacuation plan to get American citizens out of Ukraine, which is not a great sign after our last evacuation plan. That's what I guess that's the joke I've heard on sites like Babylon Bee and others, is that Biden, he'll come up with some sort of really bad evacuation plan and then leave $86 billion worth of American weapons behind for the Russians to take.
Well, that's a genuine point that America has supplied tremendous amount of weaponry to Ukraine. And if we do just say, well, you need to surrender to Russia, then essentially that's all going into the hands of the Russians.
Right, right. I don't know if it would be $86 billion in the Donbass region, but it would be a good amount. Mm-hmm. And so that's you're really looking at, if you're Ukrainian or even an American in Ukraine right now, there's not tremendous reason for optimism in that, like I said, the Biden administration's basically come out and said they're not going to be doing anything about this. Other than to maybe slap some sanctions on Russia's energy sector, which is one of those things that, like, now if Germany said they'd slap sanctions on Russia's energy sector, that's a big deal because they buy a lot of energy from Russia. Mm. If America slaps sanctions on Russia's energy sector, we don't buy any energy from Russia anyway. Mm. And so it's kind of like me boycotting tofu or something like else, like I just don't eat. It's, no one cares.
The tofu industry will be just
the
fine.
Tofu industry will be fine.
Yeah. Well, so we were talking with Brent about America evacuating from the Middle East, evacuating from Afghanistan, and now drawing down in Iraq. And there are some analysts that are saying, well, we need to do that. The United States needs to do that because those troops that are stationed in the Middle East are needed to address threats like Russia invading Ukraine or China invading Taiwan. So at the same time that you have this, it seems to me like the naivety of those analysts that are looking at that and saying that the United States is smart to leave those regions so it can address more pressing threats are ignoring the fact that this is we're seeing a broad trend of withdrawal and just basically disappearing from the world scene on the part of this administration.
Right. Well, I think the precedent set by the Afghanistan withdrawal is really encouraging Putin to do what he's doing now. And then if there is a Ukrainian withdrawal, that's going to just encourage Iran and Russia and China to be more belligerent. So you'd probably see a withdrawal from trying to withdraw citizens from Taiwan next, which is, really just powering these three nations in particular, Iran, Russia, and China, which, just to put a prophetic prophetic analysis on it, there's dozens of Bible prophecies about, like, the withdrawal and weakening of the United States in the end time in the United States and Britain in prophecy. Mr. Armstrong goes through prophecies in Micah about how the Israelite nations are like a lion in the forest, but that he'll break the pride of their power and throw down their strongholds, and all their military power will be useless. But for another major prophecy is, like, just looking at Europe's response to something like this, is that, like, Europe's kind of concerned about what Iran's doing, and it's kind of concerned about what Russia's doing. Yep. And now we've withdrawn from Afghanistan, gave $86 billion worth of weapons to the Iranians, looks like preparing to withdraw from Ukraine and give however many multiple millions of dollars we've sold to the Ukrainians to the Russians, which it's really going to be, if I was the leader of the European Union, I'd be thinking of ways to make peace with Russia in the short term and find another way to defend myself against them in the long term, because you definitely know that America is not going to do it.
Right. Well, in talking with Brent, we were just discussing how all of the nations within the Middle East, seeing America's withdrawal, is forcing them into these kinds of alliances and coalitions with one another to, be a hedge against what Iran is doing within the region. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, the fact that the United States is basically saying, "I'm sorry, you're on your own," that forces Europe to have to stand on its own two feet, and they know they're going to have to deal with the Russian threat on their own.
Right. It reminds me, back in 2009, when the Czech Republic signed the Lisbon Treaty that was kind of touted as the EU Constitution at the time, he had a really powerful quote, because he didn't want to sign the Lisbon Treaty, but he said, "It's better to kiss the German Chancellor than to hug the Russian bear." Just kind of like showing that they said a lot of these Eastern European nations are in that same in that same spot, that if America is withdrawing from Ukraine and Putin's got 90,000 troops on the border ready to annex Donbass for all practical reasons, then a lot of these nations, like Poland and some of the Balkans ones and Czechoslovakia, it's like they've got a kind of a checkered history with Germany not treating them well, but they do figure it's probably better to just kiss the German Chancellor to hug the Russian bear, as that Czech premier said. And you could really see that pushing Europe together.
All right. Well, we thank you very much for that, Andrew. Where would you send people for more information about the prophetic significance of what we're seeing here?
Well, the article I have in my notes to advertise as a nation-destroying presidency by our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, that would actually cover a little bit more about just how destructive the Biden administration has been to America's standing on the world scene by doing things like this. But also, I think putting Germany's conquest of the Balkans in the show notes would really show what you can kind of expect from Germany in a situation like this. I mean, that book talks about the world dismembering Serbia to give Kosovo to Germany and the European Union, and Putin really cited that dismembering of Kosovo as a precedent for what he's doing in Ukraine and now Donbass, in, like, basically retaliation. And so that can really kind of take you back all the way to the beginning of where this whole tit for tat between Europe and Russia started, trying to dismember these Balkans and Eastern European nations where each of them get their pieces.
All right. We thank you very much, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, news about China moving into Africa's west coast, some interesting speeches from Pope Francis, and pro-abortionists in America reacting to the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling being under threat. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
China continues its imperialistic march, now seeking a foothold on Africa's Atlantic coast. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this was first reported by the Wall Street Journal on Sunday. Their reporters interviewed U.S. military officials and were told that classified American intelligence shows that China is establishing its first permanent military presence on the Atlantic Ocean. And it's happening in the tiny Central African country of Equatorial Guinea. So this means that China's burgeoning navy will very soon apparently be able to rearm and refit just across the Atlantic from America's east coast. And these officials said this threat is setting off all kinds of alarm bells at the White House and the Pentagon, since it shows just how rapidly China's global reach is expanding and how China is establishing more of a Western Hemisphere presence as well. It's also very telling, I think, that back in October, the U.S. had actually sent a team to Equatorial Guinea to try to persuade the government there to reject China's plan to build. But this news from this week shows that those U.S. efforts failed and that China's construction is apparently already underway. We do know that China has already built a deep water port on Equatorial Guinea's coast, but that one is a commercial port. It's one of about 100 commercial ports that China has built around Africa in the last couple of decades. So it's unclear right now whether the Chinese will convert that commercial port into a military one or whether they plan to just leave it as is and build their naval port nearby. But in either case, this will be just a major milestone for China to have its first permanent military base on the Atlantic, and it does show just how quickly China's global reach is expanding.
Why is China interested in Africa's west coast?
Well, I think this it's partly about just a desire to control Africa's resources. The continent, we know, is just remarkably resource-rich. Equatorial Guinea specifically, they just discovered huge reserves of offshore oil and gas a few years back. And China, of course, is the world's biggest importer of energy. So that's clearly part of China's motivation here. And then there's also an interest, an intensifying interest by China to control more of the world's strategic ports and shipping lanes and other important maritime locations. You know, China is engaged in an explosive naval buildup, and they're eager to be able to control more of the world's shipping, including that happens around Africa. And we've written on thetrumpet.com several times about Germany and the EU deepening their influence in Africa and just working to exert more control over big areas of the continent. And the story is similar with China. So I think this brings to mind the Bible prophecies about Europe in the near future uniting and going on a warpath. And then Daniel 11 says, at a certain point, it'll become concerned about tidings out of the east and out of the north. So that's the prophesied Asian bloc led by Russia and China that we spoke about in the first half. So this is all about Europe becoming concerned and even obsessed with reports of China and Russia's activities and then preparing to take very decisive military action against it. So in Africa right now, I think you can see one area where the stage is being set for this prophesied Asian bloc led by China and Russia to clash with the European bloc led by Germany as this competition for resources and for control of choke points and shipping lanes heats up. And even if you look just at Equatorial Guinea, that used to be a Spanish colony. You know, so I think the Europeans would certainly be concerned now to see China moving in and working to convert it into a Chinese colony.
And where would you send people for more information about that struggle for resources?
Yeah, we have an article from our archives. It's called The Battleground. It's written by you, Mr. Hilliker, and by Mr. Rob Morley. And it shows quite compellingly, I think, how China and Europe are in competition for Africa and how that will play a significant role in the third and final world war. And we can really see the stage being set for that right now. So I would just encourage any listeners who would like to better understand this to check out the show notes for this episode for a link to that article called The Battleground.
Thank you, Jeremiah. We spoke in the first half about how European politicians need help from the Vatican. Pope Francis has been making some politically and prophetically significant statements lately. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Pope Francis has had a very busy week traveling around Europe, especially Greece. He's made quite a lot of pretty notable speeches. One of the ones that got the most attention, I think, was one that he gave where he talked about how Europe needs to do more to bring in migrants, and he attacked Europe for keeping out migrants. But I think perhaps more significant were the steps that he made towards unity with the Greek Orthodox Church. So he met the primate of the autocephalous Orthodox Church of the Greeks. So that's the head of the Greek section of the Greek Orthodox Church, as opposed to the head of the whole Greek Orthodox Church. But a lot of this meeting was all about coming together and about unity between Orthodox and Catholics. And for example, one of the things that he said was, well, he asked for forgiveness from God and from our brothers and sisters for the mistakes committed by many Catholics, which is a pretty unprecedented statement coming from the Pope. It's not very often you hear those kind of apologies. So, you know, this kind of statement raised a lot of expectations for unity between these. Now, the largest Orthodox Church is the Russian Orthodox Church, and so these kind of statements immediately aroused questions about unity with the Russian Orthodox Church. And the Pope talked about that, and he said, well, he opened up the possibility of going and holding a meeting with the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill. He's met with him before. I think it was 2016 in Cuba that he last met with that patriarch. And he said that he was ready to go to Moscow. And, he said, I'm ready to go to Moscow for dialogue with a brother. And he said that that the patriarch was on a horizon that is not too far. So that basically raising hopes for this coming together between the Orthodox, whole of the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church.
Well, do you want to talk about just the prophetic significance of that before we move on to anything else that the Pope has been saying?
Sure. Yeah. Those are very specific forecasts from Herbert W. Armstrong, where he talked about the Catholic Church bringing in all of its dissenting daughters, bringing in the Protestant daughters that left the Catholic Church. But he talked about the Orthodox community as well. That article, or we have a chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, called Returning to the Fold, and it goes through some specific scriptures that prophesy this unity. And Mr. Armstrong wrote, he was writing about that all the way back in the 50s. And since then, there have been a whole number of steps towards this. And the Catholic and Orthodox churches, they've come a long way towards unity already. They've even got a situation where they will recognize each other's communion as valid in certain extreme situations. Even that is a pretty big concession. And so there aren't too many steps left before kind of restoring these two groups to full communion. And some of the Pope's comments did certainly make it sound like that could happen pretty soon.
So there were also some statements that Pope Francis made directed at European leaders that we found interesting. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, like I said, it's been a busy week for him. The EU produced a 32-page inclusive language guide that's full of the kind of typical PC nonsense that we're used to from the far left these days. You know, don't say man-made climate change. You should say human-induced climate change. It's got a lot more syllables. But this guide also bans Christian language. So it tells European bureaucrats don't talk about Christmas and some of these other Christian backgrounds of Europe. And a lot of people weren't happy about this, quite understandably, not just the Pope, but the Pope was furious. He basically said, well, he said that this was banning these Christian terms was a fad, watered down secularism. It is something that throughout history has not worked. He said, in history, many dictators have tried to do these things. I'm thinking of Napoleon, the Nazi dictatorship, the communist one. The European Union must be careful not to take the path of ideological colonization. This could end up dividing countries and causing the EU to fail. Now, with those statements, he's doing quite a bit of rewriting history of the Catholic Church's relationship with people like Napoleon and with Nazi Germany. But I think this point is really interesting. The European Union has long had a component that has close relations with the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church has thoroughly supported the European integration. You have had a whole lot of popes speak out in favor of it. But the European Union has also had this kind of secularist, pretty left-wing component too. And you've seen some of these clash at times. Where, for example, a European commissioner was almost denied his seat, I think it was quite a few years ago, because he was against abortion. But this, I think, is the most notable kind of clash in these two different intellectual traditions within the European Union. And certainly, I think, one of the most direct criticisms of this kind of leftist secularism that you have in the European Union that we've seen from the Catholic Church for quite some time. I think Pope Benedict would also speak out against it pretty strongly. Just to have a Catholic Church, a Pope really telling Europe, you know, you've got to get back to your Christian roots. You've got to stop downplaying your Christian roots or the European Union will fail. I mean, in a lot of ways, that's what we were talking about in the first half, that the European Union needs a force for unity that's different to what some of these strongmen can provide, some kind of common heritage to glue these nations together. And really, only the Catholic Church can provide that. And I think at the time where you've got this big need, you can see the Catholic Church stepping up and offering that. And it ties into what we started by talking about as well, a Catholic Church that has brought unity between Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox Christians. That is a glue of unity then that spreads throughout the European Union and dramatically increases their power and credibility in bringing unity to all of Europe. So, you know, the Bible says, and Herbert W. Armstrong stated repeatedly, that the Catholic Church would be the only way that Europe could come together. He talked about all the different ways that they were trying and failing to come together without the Catholic Church, and saw quite clearly from the Bible that it would not work without it. And so they need this. And then even this Pope is kind of stepping up, at least to a certain extent, and telling them how much they need the Catholic Church's help and intervention.
Very interesting to have that coming from Pope Francis. I think there are probably a lot of people that, staunch Catholics or conservatives that don't necessarily agree with a lot of what he says, and the fact that he's coming out and saying something that they would agree with. I mean, it does show the direction of the Catholic Church, the role that it is prophesied to play within Europe. I have to say, I'm glad that European bureaucrats are ensuring that we have sexual equality for assigning blame for climate change. I think that's an important step. But otherwise, we appreciate you bringing that to us. And we will put that chapter from He Was Right in the show notes, Returning to the Fold, just a very important prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about years ago that we see coming to fruition. Thank you for that, Richard. In America, with Roe v. Wade looking like it could be overturned by the Supreme Court next year, leftists are working hard to try to secure the right to abortion. For this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, definitely keep your eye on the Supreme Court in the weeks ahead. They've been hearing oral arguments in the case Dobbs versus Jackson's Women Health Organization. And just in summary, that case is basically the state of Mississippi is trying to ban abortion after the first 15 weeks of pregnancy. They've been sued by this Jackson's Women Health Organization, and the case has made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it looks like initially the pro-lifers are pretty optimistic that they'll get a five-justice majority saying that the state of Mississippi can do this. They can make a state law that bans abortion after the first 15 weeks of pregnancy, which would be a huge deal because it would basically overturn the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision, which says that the states do not have a right to ban abortion, that every woman in America has a federal right to abort their babies. And so a huge deal, something conservatives have been wanting ever since 1973. The liberal justices hearing these arguments, I mean, if you hear some of their speeches, they almost sound like funeral dirges. Mm-hmm. They're just so upset, which shows how much the liberal justices love abortion, but also how pessimistic they are at the chance that Roe versus Wade is going to be upheld. There's even some other like Massachusetts state level senators who've talking about like a potential revolution in the United States as like young people start rioting over the loss of their abortion rights. The governor of California is coming out, and he's almost, you listen to his speech, he almost sounds like it's a done deal, where he's saying that he's already taking steps to try to preserve California as an abortion sanctuary for all these women from Mississippi and other conservative states that follow Mississippi's lead to right. come there and get their abortions instead. So a pretty big deal. Well, article we'll put in the show notes is the Trumpet Brief by Mr. Stephen Fleury, entitled Supreme Court Abortion Decision Could Lead to Much More. And he's taking that from in the prophetic context of Amos 7 and 2 Kings 14 and these scriptures his father has been drawing so much attention to about this kingdom's court that supports an end time Jeroboam, President Donald Trump, in this end time, that this court will have probably a big role in even bringing President Trump back to power and overturning the election fraud. Now, this case, Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization, doesn't have anything to do with an election fraud, but it just does show, because Roe versus Wade is such a landmark controversial case, that those conservative justices, three of whom President Trump appointed, are starting to show a little more backbone in standing up for what the Constitution actually says and making some decisions, even if the radical left doesn't like them, which is exactly the attitude they're going to have to take if you're going to expose the theft of the 2020 U.S. election.
A little bit of good news amid all of the tough news. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. We'll certainly link to that. We'll also link to an article that we put up in our print edition some years ago, The Inspiring Truth Abortionists Should Know. The whole abortion issue really is one that you need to understand based on the truth of the Bible. And it is a very important issue in its own right. And it's good that the Supreme Court is taking that up. We thank you for that. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal, and thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edward R. Murrow: to be persuasive, we must be believable. To be believable, we must be credible. To be credible, we must be truthful. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.